It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says unpredictable schedules are making life difficult for many low-wage workers. She tells us about the Fair Work Week campaign. First, for almost 20 years, the state has placed heavy restrictions on mining for gold, copper, and other sulfide ores. But now Governor Scott Walker is expected to sign a Republican-backed bill that would repeal those mining rules. There's a special provision in the bill that encourages local governments to look at their own mining regulations. Republican State Senator Jerry Petruski wrote an amendment that would give municipalities time to draft their own rules on mining after the state bill is signed into law. Senator Petruski is with us now. He's from Wisconsin's 29th District, which includes Taylor and Marathon counties. Senator Petruski, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Let's get into that provision. You put an amendment that gives, I think it's 6 months for local governments to take a look at their own mining regulations.
Correct. It just delays the effective date of the bill. Rather than being the day after publication, it puts in a six-month waiting period.
And why was that important to you?
Well, I think it's really important to make sure that local governments have a seat at the table if either mining or processing is going to be happening in their area. And I think one of the reasons it's important is that if a mining permit is filed and the ordinances or the zoning, they want to change it after the fact, that becomes a real problem. So you want to make sure that they have everything in place before any permits are filed, and this will give them time to do that. As part of this, I also drafted a letter to the counties association and the towns association asking them to make some effort to maybe have some type of standardized template that local governments could use. Because, you know, you can see we have 72 counties. If all 72 counties wanted to hire a lawyer to do this, duplication, the cost would be huge. And I think if the association were to do this, I think they could really help a lot of the towns and a lot of the counties come up with the legitimate language that would at least give each municipality a seat at the table.
Now, the goal of this legislation was to hopefully boost Wisconsin's economy by making it a little more possible for this kind of mining to happen. Are you worried that local governments might stall the process?
Well, I'm not. I think local control is really an important factor in this, and I just think it could be very, very good for local governments as far as the money, the revenue flowing in, but I think they have to be prepared. And to plan their future, you know, we went through this whole business about planning for local government. This is just another step that should be included in that.
And was this a deal breaker for you? Would you have not voted for this legislation if this six-month time period wasn't inserted in there?
Well, let me answer it this way. This provision was one of five things that I thought were really important that needed to be addressed. And if those five amendments would not have been included, no, I would not have voted for it.
What were some of the other key points that you wanted to make sure you and your colleagues tackled before passing this?
Well, I think they're all important things. There, one provision made sure that the mining companies cannot avoid paying the net proceeds tax in Wisconsin by, you know, transferring ore and selling to a variety of companies, whether they're in the country or even out of the country. So to make sure that revenue has that authority, that was one of them. Clarifying the 10,000-ton limit in dealing with the bulk sampling provisions within the bill. I wanted to make sure that it included not only the ore, but any kind of overburden or any kind of material that was extracted at that time to be part of that 10,000-ton limit. I felt that that was also very important so that everybody was on the same page and you didn't have a situation where there was very small samples and they'd have to excavate a lot of material before they could even get to the sample, and then it was 10,000 tons just of the sample. The allowing a judge to suspend operations while there is a contested mining permit hearing, I thought that was important. The six-month put off, I thought was really important. There was another provision to make sure that the DNR would be reasonably certain that technology that was being used by the mining company would result in compliant with the environmental regulations. So those five I thought were really important for the bill, and I'm happy because there was a lot of other people that worked with us, including Representative John Spiros, who introduced the bills in the assembly that night, and to thank all of those people for making sure those five amendments got added.
We're talking to Republican State Senator Jerry Petruski, looking at the state's new mining bill passed in the legislature, waiting an expected signature from Governor Walker and some amendments that he got into those bills. Senator Petruski, I understand that this could be an active issue in your neck of the woods. There are some potential mining sites in Marathon County and nearby. Is that right?
Yes, there's one in Marathon County, I believe. There's one in Taylor County. There's some in Rust County. Up along Highway 8, I think there's a number of deposits there. A lot of the discussion in this non-ferrous mining bill dealt with a mine that was located outside of Ladysmith in Rust County. And mining can be something very positive, but it's also very important that it's done safely and that we protect the environment.
And what are you hearing from city and county government officials in your district about what they think of the mining law and how they might weigh in on it?
Well, I think there's a whole variation going from county to county or town to town. But I know that a number of county officials were really concerned about the time limit, because if the bill took effect immediately after it was posted or after it was signed, that doesn't give them much time to react or to put something in place. Some of the counties across the North Woods really had no zoning dealing with sulfide mining. So all of that, I think, is really important, because they need to be at the table when all these things are happening.
Now, looking at the bill as a whole, not just your amendments now, there are concerns from environmentalists and some others that this could open the door to environmental damage in the state. How do you think that this new mining law, the lifting of the mining moratorium, would protect the environment?
Well, I can only go by a person that is much more involved in this than I am, is probably George Meyer. He used to be the Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources, and now he is the director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. And I think George did a lot of work on this bill in dealing with the original amendments that were put on. And I know that he has said that this is going to be one of the strongest non-ferrous mining bills probably in the country.
And looking again at your district, at your area, do you see this being a potential economic boost and job creator if, in fact, these sulfide mines do come into Marathon and Taylor counties?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow. I think it's probably going to take a number of years. But I think there are certainly some economic benefits that could be derived. This net proceeds taxes could certainly help a variety of people, including local governments, county governments, and the number of people that would be employed, of course, is dependent on how big the deposits are and if any processing is done here or if it's sent out of state.
And as you know, I'm sure, there have been a lot of controversies over mining in the state, thinking back about the Crandon mine, the proposed iron mine up north, even water extraction was a big issue a while back. Do you see this, as mines are proposed in the state, do you see this being another in a long series of big battles here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think all those things are going to be looked at. And keep in mind that, it's dependent if they do a pit or if it's a mining shaft going down. If you're going to drill very deep, you're probably going to run into some water, and it's what they do with that water, how are they going to process it, that will have an effect. And one of the things that we had looked at earlier in the bill was making sure that there are baselines established with sample wells and with rivers that are close by. Because if you don't have a baseline, you don't know if anything has changed, because just having this ore in that proximity could have an effect on what's already in the river. And so we wanted to make sure that that baseline was in place so that down the road, after mining would start, we would be able to go back and compare what the amount of those things in the river is compared to what was prior to mining.
And as we wrap up, Senator Petrusky, this is passed by both chambers of the legislature, as we mentioned. Do you have an idea of when Governor Walker might sign off on this and then kick off that six-month waiting period?
I am told that it's probably going to be fairly soon, but I haven't talked to the governor, and so I other than that, I don't have much of an idea.
We'll be watching that same as you then. Senator Petrusky, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's State Senator Jerry Petrusky. He's from Wisconsin's 29th District, which includes parts of Marathon County and Taylor County. He joined us to talk about amendments he added to the state's new mining bill. In part, they would allow time for municipalities to enact their own mining regulations and review their own zoning procedures when it comes to mining. Right now, lower-wage workers at many businesses may have an unpredictable schedule, not knowing their hours until a week or even a day in advance, or maybe being on call for shifts that they may or may not end up getting paid for. It's called just-in-time scheduling. It helps businesses have exactly the right staffing level for the needs of any given day. But critics say the uncertainty makes life difficult for employees. They're pushing for local ordinances and state laws to guarantee more predictable schedules. Carrie Gleason joins us now. She's the Fair Work Week Initiative Director at the Center for Popular Democracy. Carrie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, for people who aren't familiar with it, what is just-in-time scheduling?
Well, just-in-time scheduling is an approach to workforce management that's primarily seen in the service sector, where employers will micro-adjust people's work hours to match the ebb and flow of customer traffic. But what it does is that it really pushes the instability in doing business onto workers. And so what we're seeing right now is people who work on the front lines of today's service economy and retail, food service, hotels are really at risk of really unstable last-minute work schedules that fluctuate tremendously.
Can you talk about what kind of impact that has on the workers to not know what their schedule is going to be next week or maybe even tomorrow?
I mean, it's like a roller coaster. So I mean, today, most people don't realize most people in America are paid by the hour. So that's 3 in 5 people. And when we see trends like this emerge in the service economy, which is such a huge part of employment, it really is something that we all should be concerned about. And so for families, it's not just that you have tremendous amount of income volatility. It makes it impossible to budget or make ends meet. But also it means that you can't set up healthy routines. Like, I know what it's like with my 4-year-old. When I change plans last minute, he throws a tantrum. And that's what happens to working parents of young kids across the country. When they can't set up healthy routines, it's really, really constrained the families, and especially young kids.
And talk about the concept of clopening is one example people have given. So that might mean somebody works till a late night close today and then opens early tomorrow.
Yes, exactly. And, we all know that 8 hours is a mark of a good night's rest. And what we're seeing is that's basically the amount of time that many people who work for, big food service and retail chains experience. And so when we think about how long it takes to commute, I mean, I know some people in Wisconsin take multiple buses to get to their job. And so when you're doing it late at night and early morning, I mean, it means that some people who are serving you coffee or selling you your groceries are only getting just a few hours of rest.
And talk more about the exact kind of businesses. You've mentioned generally food service and retail, but are we talking big chain stores, fast food franchises?
Yes, I mean, we're talking about McDonald's, we're talking about Target and Walmart, we're talking about clothing stores like The Gap or Victoria's Secret. It's all the big brands that you know. It's really what it's like, for people who are working at these places.
And in the midst of this campaign, you've talked to workers around the country. What kind of stories do you hear from them?
I mean, it's tough. I can't tell you how many moms I've spoken to that basically just give up because they're not getting enough hours. Their commute is too long. It's too much of a scramble. to arrange for childcare. And so they're backing out of the workforce. I've seen this at moms that work at Zara and Starbucks and Taylor, who just basically give up. And that really, when we think about the problem of, like, you know, equal opportunity for women, we just did a survey of 1,000 people who work in retail across the country. And 60% of the women we talked to said that you have to be available all the time. You have to have open availability, and you have to be able to work a variable work schedule in order to get a promotion. And so when we ask ourselves, well, why aren't women advancing in today's economy? It's these types of practices that are really holding us back.
We're talking to Carrie Gleason, Fair Work Week Initiative Director at the Center for Popular Democracy, about just-in-time scheduling, unpredictable schedules for workers, and efforts to change that. And let's get into that, Carrie. A big part of what you're doing there is trying to change local and state ordinances and laws. Can you talk about what you would like to see more of?
Yeah, I mean, that there's been a new movement emerging in cities and states across the country where we're finally updating the standards for today's work week. And so we've seen 6 cities and the state of Oregon, and most recently New York State, set new standards, new policies that give people more advance notice, more stability in their hours, compensation when they're on call, and the opportunity to both work enough hours and have some flexibility. And, you know, for example, you know, some of these policies include 2 weeks advance notice, and if the employer wants to change the schedule, they can, but they have to give an extra hour of pay. And so what it really does is it starts to set a new balance between people who are, you know, working by the hour for these large corporations and start to actually compensate them for their flexibility, you know, and for their time when they're keeping work, you know, keeping themselves available to work.
I wonder about the response from a franchise owner of a fast food restaurant, you know, thinking, okay, yes, there's a big corporate logo on my shop, but I'm a small business owner. My margins are tight. This sounds like something that's going to really limit my flexibility as a business owner. What would you say to that franchise owner?
Well, I'll say, you know, they should take a closer look at what their turnover was this year. And many of these fast food chains, the turnover is more than 100%. And when you think about the cost of recruitment, the cost of understaffing when people don't show up to shifts that never worked for them in the first place, when you think about what it takes to actually have, you know, good morale, customer service is really what makes a big difference for a lot of these retail chains as we think about the pressures of online retailing. Actually, what I think what we're seeing is a lot of businesses who are taking a closer look at what their current practices are, they're seeing all these downstream costs. And so that's why we're seeing a lot of chains start to change their practices voluntarily, because they're starting to become aware, like, actually, this isn't working for us either. And so that's what we'd say. You know, if you really think about, you know, what's a family sustaining work week of, you know, giving people enough hours that they can count on, being responsive when they make reasonable requests, these are things that even, you know, like a small, you know, franchisee can totally comply with.
Is that part of your initiative, too, not just working at the local and state government level, but working with maybe moral and financial persuasion for chains?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a real culture change happening now in the service economy where companies are starting to talk about employee engagement, right, instead of an on-demand workforce. And, you know, I think that's a lot of what we're trying to do is a culture change. I mean, I think there is the business case to be made for why actually a stable balanced work hours makes sense for companies. But, I mean, when you think about the cost of families and how much economic insecurity that people are experiencing from one day to the next, I mean, it's just not what we should be seeing for work, what it means to work in this country today. And when we, a lot of working people are really starting to speak up, and what we see in terms of responses from their employers like Starbucks or Walmart, these companies are not saying, well, this is just how it is. They're responding and they're saying, actually, we want people to be able to, like, be with their families and support their families, and we're going to change our practices.
I know there are no ordinance efforts here in Wisconsin on this particular issue, but has your campaign done work here in the state?
Yes, we've worked with groups in Wisconsin. You know, I think I can think of one woman who I worked closely with, Mary Coleman, who worked at a Popeyes in Wisconsin. And her story, I mean, really speaks to why we all need a fair work week. I mean, she talks about, you know, taking a bus, two buses, in the middle of a Wisconsin winter to get to her hot Popeyes, only to be told that she wasn't needed that day and had to turn home. And for someone like Mary, I mean, that's like a net loss in pay. And many states actually have a law where if you show up to work, they have to give you a minimum pay for reporting to work. And, I mean, that's exactly the type of solution that, you know, working people in Wisconsin deserve and really need. And so, you know, I think it's only a matter of time where before we see policymakers in Wisconsin really start to step up on this issue. There has been some interest. I will say also, you know, there have been, you know, through people working in these companies speaking up, we've seen corporations change. So in the last few years, about 13 major retail brands ended the practice of on-call scheduling. And that's a practice where you get scheduled for a shift, you aren't guaranteed any work, but that you can be disciplined if you're not available for that shift. And so it's a terrible practice. It really puts people to put their lives on hold. And we moved companies like The Gap and Victoria's Secret and J. Crew to end that practice. And that impacts the lives of people who work in the clothing stores in Wisconsin.
We'll leave it there for now. Carrie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me. Have a great day.
That was Carrie Gleason, Fair Work Week Initiative Director at the Center for Popular Democracy. First, as digital technology becomes more and more essential to our everyday lives, so does the importance of cybersecurity. At the core of that is our data, which, as we find out from time to time, isn't as secure as we'd like it to be. In an attempt to protect data, encryption has emerged as a popular and useful tool, shielding our online conversations and other data from those who shouldn't be seeing it and offering other protections as well. But some government agencies have pushed back, according to our next guest. Because criminal investigations can sometimes be hampered by encryption, these agencies pushed for a weakening of protections, which could make it easier to crack into a secured iPhone or computer system. She says that's the wrong move, especially at a time when we're more reliant on data and devices than ever. Susan Landau is a bridge professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and the School of Engineering's Department of Computer Science at Tufts University. Her new book is Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. Susan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, a core problem, it seems, Susan, that you're pointing out in your book is that technology has evolved really quickly. We're doing more and more stuff with it, and we really have not kept up with it in terms of law and our personal behavior. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. We used to talk ephemerally. That is, I would have a conversation with you in person or maybe on the phone, and there'd be no record of it except in our own minds. Now, when we do email, when we do instant messaging, lots of those types of communication are kept permanently, and we don't really think about the consequence of keeping various of those messages permanent. At the same time, law enforcement is still hearkening back to the kinds of tools it had 20 years ago. It has different kinds of tools now, many more, but some of the tools it had, like wiretapping, are sometimes harder to use.
On a personal basis, I think we can all hear, you know, protect your data. Yeah, that's important. We don't want identity theft or our credit records hacked or anything like that. But when we talk about solutions like data protection or encryption, our eyes glaze over. We think that's stuff for a big, fancy government institution or something like that. Is this something we should be trying to get excited about and interested in?
I think rather than excited, I think part of the problem has been technologists haven't made the systems as easy to use as possible. That's changing now somewhat. There are companies like Duo in Michigan or Google has Google Authenticator, which makes it easier to do what's called second-factor authentication. So in addition to using a password to access an account, you actually have to use a different factor, like some data from your phone, some data that is computed on your phone, so that if you don't have your phone or if somebody else doesn't have your phone, they've just stolen your password, they can't get on.
Let's talk about that encryption angle, and I mentioned the federal law enforcement agencies on the one hand and technology companies and others on the other. Spell out this encryption debate for us.
Sure. There are two issues in the encryption debate. There's what's called end-to-end encryption, which is encrypting communications. So if you and I were talking on a telephone and we had the communication end-to-end encrypted, you'd be able to understand me because it would be decrypted at your end. I'd be able to understand you because it would be decrypted at my end. But anybody who listened in, any wiretap in the middle, wouldn't be able to hear anything but noise. So that's end-to-end encryption. The other issue is locked devices, like the iPhone of the San Bernardino terrorist. Apple and Android have both started making the phones harder to open up without knowledge of the password, and that was to protect data on the phones. People increasingly keep all sorts of personal and professional information on the phone, and it was subject to identity theft and other problems. And so Apple first and then Android began making it harder to open the phones. Well, law enforcement objects because while they believe in security for individuals, they also want to be able to do investigations, and they found the wiretapping has become more difficult, and now opening phones has as well.
Your concern there, though, is that if we give a back door, as people call it, to, say, the FBI to get into anybody's phone whenever they want to, there's no way to restrict it so that only the FBI is going to know about it.
Well, it's close, but not quite it.
Okay.
The problem is that when you create a break in the encryption, when you make it easier for somebody else to get in, you create a more complex encryption system. We know from decades of building computer systems that complexity is the enemy of good security. Once you make it easy for one person to break in, then you make it easier for others. That's one problem. Another problem is that technology has enabled us to recapture some of that ephemerality of communications. That is, when you and I talk, you and I know it, but you'll just repeat what I said to somebody else. It won't be my words unless it's a piece of email, in which case you can forward it. What encryption enables us to do is a kind of technique called forward secrecy, in which each communication has its own encryption key, making it much more secure. It means that somebody who wanted to capture all of our communications would have to break each and every key. That's too hard. If law enforcement had its way, one of the problems is we'd lose that protection. So we lose all sorts of protections because what law enforcement wants makes it harder to have good security. The same thing is true about opening phones, that the kinds of protections that Apple, and I know the Apple technology somewhat better, so that's the one I'll speak to, the kind of protections that Apple has put into securing the phones become vulnerable if law enforcement, which is to say the FBI, has its way and it becomes easier to open phones rather than harder.
We're talking to Susan Landau. Her new book is called Listening, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. Susan, can you talk about how the threat to our cybersecurity has developed over the years, what targets there are, and who's chasing these targets?
Sure. So back in the 80s, it was governments going after military information. And the U.S. found it out because of a 75-cent discrepancy in an account at Lawrence Berkeley Labs. By the 1990s, governments were going after government information. What did the EPA know? What did other government agencies know? And so it was other governments going after the U.S., but presumably also the U.S. was also eavesdropping elsewhere. In the 2000s, it shifted completely, and it shifted to lots of cyber espionage, cyber exploits against the private sector, theft of intellectual property, and I don't mean movies and films. I mean software. I mean plans for creating drugs or airplane wings or all sorts of information like that. So taking research that took years to develop, stealing it, and then building that same equipment somewhere else without having to invest in all the intellectual work to get there. What we saw in the last election was something else entirely. We saw the weaponization of political information. So we'd seen political information stolen before, but the release of Hillary Clinton's emails, drip by drip by drip by WikiLeaks, created a dynamic within the campaign that was very hard to recover from. That combined with the fake news and disinformation that was done is a real threat to civil society. And I think unanticipated by the U.S. and other governments, and quite dangerous because it's not clear how to respond.
Let's take this to the personal level now. We've got our phones with all of our stuff on it, our laptops with a lot of information. Now we're getting health sensors and monitors of various sources. What are we as individuals at risk of now?
So it depends on who you are and what it is you have to protect. You, for example, are a radio personality. You're a somewhat public figure. So there's lots more personal information that people would be interested in about you than they might be about, say, a professor or somebody working at Starbucks. But all of us have information about ourselves that we don't want known, whether it's a child who has a medical problem or a family member who maybe drinks too much, or maybe the fact that we didn't do so well on an exam or we lost our job before this one. So all sorts of information about ourselves, whether we're going to Alcoholics Anonymous, whether we are calling up an abortion clinic. And the information that is on our phones, it might include where we're it does include where we're calling. It includes the location history of where we've been, if we have maps turned on. All of that is very personal. And all of a sudden, they're records in a way that we've never had before.
We're talking about cybersecurity, the battle over encryption, and what the future holds for the safety of our data. Our guest is Susan Landau, author of the new book, Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Do you take cybersecurity seriously in your daily life, or do you just let it ride with whatever the default is on your phone or your laptop or the website you log into? Is it important to you that a device or app has some kind of encryption function? Do you think that federal law enforcement should have a backdoor to gain access to people's phones and other devices in criminal investigations? And again, what questions do you have for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Susan Landau is with us. Her new book is called Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. We're talking about protection of our data, encryption, and a lot more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is cybersecurity something that has you worried? How important is encryption to you on your devices? Do you ever stop and think about all the stuff you've searched for, entered online, and what the wrong people could do with that information? And what questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Susan, let's talk about what we can do first before we get to a national level. At an individual level, is there much we can do?
Sure. One thing you can do is use second-factor authentication to secure your accounts. It used to be hard to do that, but now, as I said, there are various applications. Google Authenticator is one that's free to download, and some accounts have that. Use good passwords, of course. But the other thing, I think probably the most important thing, is to look at what information is leaking out of your cell phone, what information you're supplying to different apps that you use. I tend to be quite conservative in what apps I use, and I'm very conservative on what information they can get. It means sometimes it's a little bit harder for me to use the app as well as I might because I'm limiting what information it has about me. But the trade-off for me of better security is worth it. And that's a big piece of what I do to keep myself safe.
Okay, that's us as individuals. Now, how about at the national level, the federal level? What should we be doing in the United States that we are not?
We have not thought much about liability and what happens when programs aren't secure. We haven't pushed hard to insist that everybody update all the time. So one of the things, when you asked me my last question, I should have said the most important thing I do, of course, is to update whenever the programs I'm using need it, immediately, always. And so the federal government has not always kept its own house in order. One of the reasons it hasn't kept its own house in order is we've had a mistaken belief that when you buy computers, that's the investment you do, you're done. But in fact, maintenance is the bigger issue. and keeping systems properly maintained and updated and secure is really important. So if you go back to a ransomware attack we had a year ago, in which many people's systems, the data on their systems was encrypted and they couldn't get it decrypted unless they paid a ransom, and sometimes if they did pay a ransom, they still didn't get it decrypted. Part of the problem from that came from the fact that certain places like hospitals in the UK were using old operating systems for which they didn't have patches, and that's why they were attacked.
We're talking about cybersecurity with Susan Landau, author of the new book, Listening In. We'll go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jenny is with us in Williams Bay. Jenny, hi.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. My sister, just a few days ago, was calling me convinced that her phone was listening to her. She was reading a Magic Treehouse book to her kids, and then that night she got a suggested post by Instagram for the Magic Treehouse series, and she was convinced that her phone was listening to her read the story to her kids, and that's how the suggested. I'm not laughing at her, but I think I told her it was a little bit out there, and I'm wondering if that's even possible that cell phones can do that.
Jenny, thanks for the call. Susan, the title of your book's Listening In. Is it that literal?
Yes, it's certainly the case that phones can be turned into eavesdropping devices, which is why if you're going somewhere where you are worried about being eavesdropped upon, you don't just shut it off, you actually take the battery out. That said, one of the things we think about in security is what's your threat model? Who is it who's likely to attack you? So if your sister is working for an important government agency or working for an important business that's about to launch a new product, and is about to travel somewhere where there's competition, that's one reason to suspect that maybe her phone is eavesdropping on her. Other than that, I suspect the more likely reason is that at some point recently she was actually looking for those books online and the ad just happened to turn up at the right moment. We tend to find coincidences often where there aren't coincidences. It's just that we haven't noticed the previous occurrences, and then all of a sudden when we see one just after we read a book or saw friends with twins, and then we see other twins, we say, oh, there are lots of twins, but previously we didn't notice them. So I suspect it's more noticing rather than anybody actually eavesdropping on her.
Jenny, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. This has been a concern for top government officials in the White House, the cabinet, places like that, hasn't it?
Absolutely. So that after the election, the Wall Street Journal reported that Obama's people, Clinton's people, and Trump's people were all using Signal, which is an end-to-end encrypted communication system, which has the advantage that, of course, because of the way the communication works, there is no saving of the communication. That is, there's no record afterwards of what people said. And so that after the Podesta email thefts, that seemed like a very important thing to do.
I'm going to look at some of the frontiers of technology now. We keep hearing about the Internet of Things, where our appliances, I guess, refrigerators, those health monitors I mentioned earlier, they're all connected to the Internet and our phones and things like that. What are your worries as we start to do this?
We don't have good privacy laws about how that such data can be used. So if you go back to the 1960s and 70s, at that period, all of a sudden, banks and financial institutions had a lot more information about whether people were able to repay loans. And the balance of power tipped towards the banks because they knew when a prospective borrower came in, they knew an awful lot about him or her. And we got the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which said, okay, the credit bureaus are not allowed to report to the banks or other financial institutions about your creditworthiness without your permission. We were controlling use of the data. One thing we don't have right now is a good model of controlling use of the data. What happens to the information from your Fitbit? You may have a privacy policy from Fitbit, but Fitbit could also change the privacy policy. We don't have good laws on controlling the use of data, and that concerns me a great deal, especially about the Internet of Things.
I want to bring on a caller again. Bernadette is with us in Wauwatosa. Bernadette, hi.
Hi. Several months ago, I like this show. It's a great show. Several months ago, somebody private messaged me, through the Facebook private message, but it's supposed to be private. a name of a doctor. I'd asked her for a referral, and I was sitting next to my laptop, but I read it on my phone. And so right after I read her private message, I went to Google on my laptop and typed in DR, and his name filled in.
Wow.
I didn't even type the first letter of his name.
Bernadette, thanks for the call. And Susan, that's a big concern, is sort of the cross-platform. Since our phones and computers do everything, they may surprise us in how they communicate.
That's right. So I can't explain this particular one, but it's certainly the case that if Facebook Messenger was open on the laptop as well as on the phone, that it could have been that the information had come there. However, how it got to Google, it's not clear to me. I would say one interesting question is to have somebody else type in your locality VR, but you also need to know what other searches you'd been doing recently, because, of course, Google tries to personalize search. So if, for example, you've been looking a lot for automobiles and you start to type in VOL, for example, now VOL might be for volume, it might be for lots of things beginning with VOL, but if you've been looking at cars a lot lately, then it's likely that Google would respond by filling in Volvo right away.
Thanks for the call, Bernadette. Susan, in our last couple minutes, we talked a little bit about federal government priorities here. With all the attacks we've seen, with what happened during the elections, do you see a sense of urgency about this?
I don't see nearly the sense of urgency that there ought to be. I think the threats to our civil society are very great. We had talked for a long time about a cyber Pearl Harbor, which people thought was exaggerated, but we understood how to respond if another government attacked critical infrastructure. We seem to have no mental model and no policy that adequately responds to attacking our civil society, not just our political parties and the election process, but more long-term, the kind of divisiveness that is being brought by outsiders to various civil discussions like Black Lives Matter, like the shooting in Texas where wrong information was posted first and rose to the top. So I think that the lack of response by the federal government to these attacks is actually very damaging, and they should be responded to as if they were what we call kinetic attacks or physical attacks.
If we can't trust our internet at this point, it's making it harder for us to trust each other. Is that right in our last few moments?
That's absolutely right. And we've lost, because of the internet, we've lost a lot of the public sector sources of information. The number of newspapers has gone down. The number of authoritative sources has gone down. And so we're relying more on the internet. But there's a lot of disinformation that's being put through it, some of it by foreign parties in an attempt to disrupt us.
Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Susan Landau. She's a bridge professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and the School of Engineering's Department of Computer Science at Tufts University. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. Still time to share your thoughts, maybe your anecdotes. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. It's Thanksgiving week. Christmas music and holiday decorations are going up all over the place, so it's not too soon to start talking about holiday-themed candy. And it's getting weird, especially in the candy cane department. When I think about weird candy, I think of producer Chris Molina. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Rob.
All right, so candy canes, we're stumbling across weird stuff. You track weird Oreo flavors, but it's going the other direction now.
So because people know my weird Oreo thing, someone brought to my attention that Oreo candy canes are a thing this year.
So these are candy canes flavored like Oreos, not Oreos flavored like candy canes.
Correct, yeah. And then so we started looking around to see, well, I wonder what other candy cane flavors are out there. And they're getting pretty pretty wild and creative, and there's the certain shock value to things like dill pickle candy canes. There's also bacon candy canes. But here's my absolute favorite. I just found this today. There is rotisserie chicken flavored candy canes, and I like this one because there's a little bit of shock value with like dill pickle candy canes or bacon candy canes, but they picked like the most mundane thing that they possibly could in the grocery store and turned it into a candy cane, and that's kind of why I like it.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those, what was the thought process? It's a candy cane. What could it taste like? How egg, scrambled egg, or chicken?
What's really going to sell this holiday?
It's what the market is demanding.
Hey, here's my thought. Rotisserie chicken.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
You're going to try these?
I'm going to try them, and I might put them on my tree to trick people into thinking they're butterscotch candy canes, only to have some severely disappointed house guests.
This is Central Time.